Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 26 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He has extensive work on gang investigations, and he's a certified analyst with IOLEA. And in fact, he is the president of IOLEA's Southwest chapter. He is currently the Crime Analysis and Research Unit Supervisor with Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Please welcome Brian Novotny. Brian, how are we doing?
Good. How are you doing today?
Thank you for having me. Oh, I am doing very well. Thank you for joining me. Looking forward to this interview. So my first question is, how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
I went through a couple of different paths to get here as a crime analyst. In 1994, I first started volunteering with the Arizona Highway Patrol as a volunteer reserve. And that was when I was taking criminal justice classes at Arizona State University. The goal was to get hired as an officer. And unfortunately, at the time, the state was going through budget issues and there's a hiring mandate and things didn't work out for the hiring process at that time period. I got hired with Liberty Mutual Insurance as a fraud investigator when I graduated from college and was working on insurance fraud investigations, focused mostly on commercial insurance fraud and workers' compensation fraud. In the process of doing that, I had to testify in court on a couple of different cases and got an interest more on the legal side of things and enrolled in paralegal school. So at the time I was doing the investigations, I just wanted to have more of a legal background, got my paralegal certification. And during the time I was doing that, I interned with Maricopa County Attorney's Office in the paralegal program. And when I graduated, they offered me a position and I got hired as a paralegal. So I spent several years working as a paralegal in different bureaus, became a paralegal supervisor here, and worked in the gang unit, sex crimes, homicide, and the Southeast Valley facility where we had all types of crimes that were we were working on, from domestic violence, everything except homicide in Mesa. So that's where I started getting more involved with the gang activity and gang bureau and working on gang cases, attended several gang trainings and gang meetings, in addition to my continuing to volunteer with the Highway Patrol, worked at both areas at the time, which led to becoming friends with the crime analyst at the Department of Public Safety, working with them on a more regular basis, and had the opportunity to test with the Department of Public Safety as crime analyst, and got hired and was assigned to the Rocky Mountain Information Network, RIMIN, which is part of the RIST projects. And had the opportunity to work there for several years, working gangs, domestic terrorism, violent extremist groups, and things like that, which led to a promotion within the Department of Public Safety, became an analyst supervisor with the State Gang Task Force. And for briefly, I had the Auto Theft Task Force analyst for about a year that worked under our unit as well. At that time, I was given an opportunity to come back to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office because they were trying to create a crime analysis unit or crime strategies unit at the time. And I was given the opportunity to come over in a capacity to help establish that unit, came here, and a couple of different things we'll discuss later on, left and was, you know, fired, got hired back. And now I became a supervisor in about a year and a half ago over the crime analysis unit. We went through some changes, but that's basically the path I went through. And during that course, I also had the chance to, back in like 2005, 2006 timeframe, get certified as a crime scene technician, which helped me with my volunteer work with the Department of Public Safety. So I went back and forth between the law enforcement, the intel side, and the prosecution side over the course of 26 plus years of doing different things and working in different areas with the crime analyst and the sworn side of DPS with the units I've worked assigned to assisting with them on different cases. So it's been a little bit of a journey on different areas and different opportunities over the course of the career. So it's been a good good ride so far.
Wow. Yeah. Long, strange trip it's been. You have your hands in quite a lot of cookie jars. So yes. Let's break that down a little bit. I guess going back to your first law enforcement stop there with Liberty Mutual fraud investigations, I guess as you look back, you know, you set out to be an officer, but you got derailed a little bit. As folks that are listening to this, maybe somebody looking to get into the law enforcement analysis profession, is it something you would recommend someone take if they have an opportunity to work fraud investigations for an insurance company?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was a great opportunity. I got into a lot of training. I kind of joke at the time because of the budget issues with our Department of Public Safety. When I was doing the fraud investigator, I made more money than the DPS sergeant at the time. So I would go joke with him when I was working. You know, I was early 20s. I had a company car. I had a corporate credit card. I was able to go out to do trainings and things like that. And I would go to like the National Insurance Crime Bureau Academy. Had a chance to do that training. I got into a lot of accident reconstruction training, and you know, highway patrol officers that were unable to get to some of the training, I would bring the training material back and share it with them, and we're friends, and obviously give them those resources and help them with their stuff on there. And it was just interesting at that point in time. I wanted to go down to law enforcement, but early 20s, and you know, making a good decent living at the time on it. So it just, you know, looking back from the retirement standpoint, I wish I had, you know, gone into the state retirement a little bit sooner. But you know, from the early 20s, when you got a company car and you're enjoying life and, you know, some of that stuff on there. Plus, you know, it was a great opportunity to network and got to see. I had some good mentors at that time. There was a couple of retired officers that were doing insurance fraud investigations. So I was learning from them through the different associations and investigation associations that they had on there, which, you know, helped expand and, you know, direct me in learning how to do interviews, learning how to document cases correctly, how to properly do an investigation on stuff, because it would lead to litigation or, you know, insurance claims. And we had, you know, commercial contracts that we had to deal with, and a lot of it was trucking. So when they were involved in an accident and you had to go out and document it, there was, you know, large dollars involved in some of those claims, you know, especially if it had a fatality on there or serious injuries there. So there's a lot of litigation that I learned and understood. And that's what kind of led me to that paralegal side, was understanding more of the legal side of stuff. I had gone through criminal justice classes at Arizona State, so I understood, you know, the law enforcement criminal justice programs, but to get into the actual litigation and civil lawsuits and things like that, but I didn't have the experience as a college student getting, you know, I always wanted to be on the cop side of stuff, and learning that civil side was a unique experience and was very valuable on it. So, and just understanding, you know, surveillance techniques on workers' comp fraud and doing stuff where you had to go out and do neighborhood canvases and getting people to, you know, start doing an interview right from the beginning, you know, just knocking on their door because they may have witnessed an accident or witnessed some sort of activity, and being able to develop those skills and that, you know, self-confidence of being able to walk up to a house and just start a conversation with someone on there. So it's great. Any experience like that, especially as you very beginning of your career, as you start out, any of those training classes, any that type of material you can get into, just makes you that much better as you develop more and more skills.
Yeah. And then with the volunteer work, that was with Highway Patrol?
Highway Patrol. Yeah. All Arizona right. Department of Public Safety, Highway Patrol. So again, you know, I worked with officers there. It was like a police aid type position on there, and I got the opportunity to experience what they were experiencing on, you know, accident scenes and investigations, traffic stops, and helping them with, you know, the documentation. You know, some of it was just grunt work in the office, but you had to learn how to do that too on there, just because you understood the big picture of, you know, transporting evidence and chain of custody and, you know, understanding how an agency operates behind the scenes. It's not always, you know, what you see on TV. You have to understand the inner workings of an agency, the admin side of it and paperwork and all that other stuff. So just, you know, that helped develop a lot of experience in addition to, you know, volunteering with going out to being part of patrol. I worked at, you know, one of the areas I was assigned was the Beeline Highway, which at the time was one of the deadlier stretches of highway in Arizona. So the holidays, we always had, you know, fatal accidents and being involved with that and understanding scene management and being in an outlying area. There was times where I'd be at an accident scene by myself for 35, 40 minutes before additional, you know, paramedics responded. So you had to have that training and being able to understand how to work a scene and secure and keep people back and all that stuff. So that was a great opportunity and experience as well.
Yeah, sounds like it. Because I'm thinking, geez, that would be a great opportunity not only to learn the craft, but learn to work with different officers and investigators, as well as get to know the area and work with the public. So that sounds like a great opportunity. Is it difficult to get that volunteer position?
You have to go through the background checks. You have to go through, you know, it's a little, each agency is different on it. You had to go through training. I went through a 3-month training program on it with, you know, making sure first aid and driver's training and, you know, how you approach people and your safety and self-defense type issues and things like that. And, you know, I was fortunate. I worked with very good officers and they're willing to take me under their wings and train me on stuff. So each agency is slightly different. Some agencies are more proactive with getting volunteers and reserves like that. Other agencies kind of hesitate against it just from liability. It's a lot more challenging now with all the issues that are going on against law enforcement today than it was back in 1994. There's a little bit more respect for law enforcement back at that time. I think, you know, agencies have to be a little bit more concerned about the threat of an employee getting assaulted at an accident scene or, you know, the random acts that occur nowadays that, you know, they did occur back at that point in time, but it wasn't anywhere near to the level of animosity towards law enforcement that you see currently in the last couple, you know, last year, year and a half with all the protests and things like that. So it's just, it's unfortunate, but, you know, it's part of law enforcement. You also understand what you're facing on a regular basis with that as you get more and more experience, because that 10 years I was in Highway Patrol led to me going to the gang task force and working 13 years in the gang task force on there. The sergeant that I had worked with in the gang unit, he and I had worked together when he was in patrol, and he brought me over because my background with the gang unit and things like that. So going over to the gang unit for 13 years, also, you know, understand the criminal investigation side of aspects of all that. So again, you know, it's well worth rounding out experience and understanding what the officers face on an everyday occurrence and, you know, what it's like at 2 o'clock in the morning to be pulling a dead body out of a car at an accident scene. You know, a lot of people don't have that experience unless they've gone through the law enforcement side of stuff. So working holidays and working different events and things like that is, it builds your understanding of what you're going to be facing in other different aspects as you move on in different areas of your career.
All right. Well, let's move on to your paralegal work. And I guess this is a good enough time as any to just make sure we put a legal disclaimer that this is your opinions, right? And yes, anything that you say here, well, is just the opinions and not representing any agency or whatnot, right?
Yes, I should have started off with that from the very beginning. These are my opinions based on training experience. Obviously, working in a law firm and law, you know, prosecutor's office, there's plenty of attorneys around. We got to make sure that it's documented correctly on that this is my viewpoint and not anything representative of Maricopa County Attorney's Office, that these are my experience and training and education and comments and that. So thank you.
Yeah. So how did the work as a paralegal influence you later on as a law enforcement analyst?
At the time, the paralegals here, our job duties were a little bit different than what they are nowadays with it. We were a lot more active with our paralegal work. When I first got hired here, I was put into the homicide unit because I had some law enforcement background on it and with my reserve work and things like that. So I got moved in and we were doing a lot of casework that I think, you know, unfortunately, the paralegals don't do as much today on there. And, you know, it might be just our office because of the structure. But we did defense interviews. We went out, you know, I worked with one of the first prosecutors I worked with as his paralegal was Bill Clayton, who was the attorney who got DNA evidence submitted into Arizona. And he created his case was the one out in Tucson with the Palo Verde tree. So I was able to gain a great amount of experience and knowledge working with him, getting into DNA evidence and other areas. I was working with him on the DNA committee, in addition to some other prosecutors in the office. And, you know, we went out to homicide scenes together. We went out and did interviews together. And, you know, I would do defense interviews with him on stuff and learn how to understand the cases and organizing a case investigation on there from what law enforcement had done. And then when they submitted to our office and understanding how to organize it and prepare it for a prosecution. And he and I sat down many times on, you know, charting out cases and the old days of butcher paper and paper on the wall and poster boards and things like that. And we'd lay out cases and walk a person through what happened in that homicide. And he was very beginning of, you know, using PowerPoints in case trials and things like that. So there's a couple of homicide cases that we'd work together and putting together PowerPoints, and you'd walk the way he would present his cases in trial was to walk a person through the homicide case. And there's one particular case I remember in Mesa where there was a dead body on the second floor of an apartment structure and on the first floor of the apartment structure, but the bodies were found a week apart on there. So we had to walk the jury through what led to the one homicide investigation leading to a second homicide. And we just, you know, through those steps, and that helped me as an analyst down the road. I understood what the detectives are going to need for their cases and what a prosecutor is looking at, you know, not in a silo process of thinking, but I understood what each aspect of the investigation process and, you know, what can be done and how we could put this together and getting it to a jury on there, which I think helps me now as a supervisor and helped me over the years putting cases together, especially, you know, when I worked at Rocky Mountain Information Network. They cover 8 states through the Rim and Rocky Mountain region. So I had to deal with different jurisdictions and different prosecutors in different states on how they presented their cases, and having that paralegal background helped me as an analyst with understanding what a prosecutor in one jurisdiction is going to be faced, the challenges, and understanding, you know, how you're going to present this to a jury and how is it going to go over, what's going to go well with the jury, what are they going to understand, what might be confusing. You know, a lot of stuff that we do as analysts is very technical with like phone analysis and the timelines and charts and things like that. We need to make sure that as you develop that for a prosecution, that you're thinking, who's your target audience and who is this finally going to go to at some point in time? If, you know, it could be the very beginning of an investigation and you're looking at it, just getting an investigation started, working with your detectives, or you're working with the prosecutor who has to present it to a jury. And they need to understand it because, you know, the person that's sitting on the jury panel doesn't understand DNA evidence, doesn't understand phone analysis, doesn't understand these steps on there. And, you know, sometimes it may be, you know, you're getting into the criminal element of stuff and they may not be exposed to that in the past on there, especially if you're dealing with people that have limited life experiences on there and they're just now getting on a jury panel. And you have to understand, you know, this is how a drug operation goes. This is money laundering. This could be, you know, phone analysis or whatever course that you as an analyst are working on to help your detective and prosecution, because you're behind the scenes in most cases and giving them the visual connecting the dots on cases and just make sure that you put it in a manner that helps. So, you know, I was fortunate with the experience I had. You know, I worked with really good prosecutors and my paralegal days, it developed that trial advocacy and understanding of how to put a case together. And I learned a lot from them on there. So it's helped as I moved on to other areas.
And you use the term defense interview. For the audience, I just want to make sure that they understand that term. Could you define that term?
Prior to, once a case is charged, it's, you know, obviously a person gets a defense attorney, then the defense attorney will prepare their case in terms of either plea negotiations or trial preparation. And in Arizona, we have to do pre-trial interviews with it, unless you're a victim of a case on there. So it's the defense attorney's opportunity to interview any witnesses in the case to prepare what they're going to testify to in the trial or help understand this is why my client needs to plead out a case on there. So we call them defense interviews, where the defense attorney gets their chance to interview a witness prior to case going to trial. 90-some percent of cases plead out, so you may never testify or very limited time of testifying as an analyst in court, but you may be called on multiple occasions to do a defense interview because you did work in that investigation. So it's very important to understand what a defense interview is, because that's where they will look at the work that you did, the quality of work you did, your credibility, your resume, your experience levels, and they challenge, and basically they're evaluating you as what type of witness you would be in a courtroom setting. So if you come across very well, you know, that may lead to a case being pled out versus having to go to trial. And, you know, if you come across as incompetent and confused and not sure what you're doing, then the defense attorney is like, okay, I may be able to, lack of better terms, destroy you on the witness stand on there. So it would call into question the investigation, depending on your role within that investigation on there. You know, if you do something critical like phone analysis and you're the one whose work is putting someone into a geographical area at a homicide case or a drug deal or something like that, you may be a crucial witness in a case. And if you don't testify to it and you come across as incompetent, and, you know, that could ruin a case in the long term on there. So even though the detectives, investigators did great work, prosecutors are doing great work, you just need to make sure that your skills are what they should be.
You mentioned 13 years working on gang investigations. What are some highlights when you think back at your time there? What were some highlights of your career then?
I focused mostly on outlaw motorcycle gangs and domestic terrorism and extremist groups and anti-government groups. I did some street stuff on there, but there's a lot of, you know, opportunities to get out and work like the Hells Angels National Run. Went to Montana, worked that. Went to Colorado, worked that. When I was assigned to Rimmon, we had different events here in Arizona that we went and worked the prison runs down to Florence on there. Different opportunities to just get out and work in the investigations. I worked with really good gang detectives at that time. I got an opportunity to serve on the Arizona Gang Investigator Association board on there, in addition to the International Outlaw Motorcycle Gang Investigation Association board. I worked with them on putting together some conferences. So I was able to network with a lot of people and information sharing, which is huge for an analyst to take that opportunities, in addition to ILEA and IACA and different analyst associations. But you also need to be involved with the different, if you're working narcotics, different narcotic associations, you're working gangs, gang associations, vehicular crimes, auto theft, whatever your area would encompass, is make sure that you get out and network with those associations as well. Because it's, you need help with something, you need those resources. You can provide information on cases, but also your, you know, networking is huge on there. So that was, you know, some of the best experiences I had were working those different events. They're also some of the most frustrating on it, because the challenges of working long hours and things going back, you know, things going bad on some situations on there. But, you know, that was also the exciting part of doing stuff, is going out and, you know, talking to gang members. And, you know, one of my mentors was Chuck Scoville, who was the president of Asgia and iOmega. And he and I were partnered on several projects over the years. And, you know, we went into the prisons and interviewed inmates in prisons as we were putting things together and understanding that aspect of the investigations of not only just the database stuff, but actually the human interaction, and realizing that you're looking at someone who is a gang member that, yes, they're extremely violent, but they're also human beings. And you're still dealing with that personality aspect of it. And yes, there were extremely violent people that you dealt with, but most of the people you're dealing with still were people just trying to get by and live in, you know, unfortunately, there's good people living in bad areas on there. And that's who you need to work for, and keep that in mind as you're working through your investigations and you're assisting either as an analyst or, you know, if there's a sworn person listening on there, keep in mind who you're still dealing with.
It's fascinating, like, hearing you talk about all these different opportunities, because you carry yourself as a sworn officer, and yet you never were a sworn officer. right?
No, I did reserve stuff, but it was never sworn.
So I think you have so much experience doing sworn type level activities there that you carry yourself as a sworn officer. Like, I would have probably lost money because I would have just by, if we were just talking without looking at your resume, I would have been like, that guy's definitely been a sworn officer.
But yeah, that goes back to the reserve stuff. I had the opportunity to work in a lot of the situations where I was put in situations with the officers on traffic stops and assisting on DUI task forces and arrests and things like that. So it just, and you know, reserve stuff allowed me to get that experience and opportunities and go out and work with those guys on enforcement activities and different events on there. So, you know, I had the opportunity to do a lot of stuff with it.
So let's talk about your transition into the Maricopa County analyst unit. I mean, I guess the analyst side of Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Just go into that decision of taking that leap, leaving where you were and starting work as an analyst.
It was good on it. I stumbled with some situations. I think that, you know, we'll discuss that on there. It was a hard decision to leave because I enjoyed the work at the gang task force, but I also had the opportunity to come over here and create something, be part of a unit that was being created to do a lot of good work with, you know, the aspect of prosecution. I was still friends with a number of prosecutors in the office that were now, when they were brand new attorneys, when I work with them, are now, you know, bureau chiefs and leaders in the office. So it, to me, it was going to be a good opportunity. Unfortunately, it kind of went sideways with some of the leadership at the prior administration with it, our prior supervisor and another prior administrator on there. You know, unfortunately, after I was here for about a year, I got terminated because I had raised issues with a project that was being implemented on it. And I had concerns with how it was being raised to potentially gave the impression that there was racial profiling on there, because the way the program was being rolled out, there was no, you know, people weren't doing anything wrong. But if you looked at it on paper on there was issues with it, because we had a program that we're trying to identify priority offenders on there, which, you know, we all have limited resources, but we need to go after the most problematic people, and who's causing the most crime was the goal of it. Unfortunately, with the way things were being rolled out, we only had a handful of detectives from one agency that were implementing it. We trained over 700 people on the program on there, and just people weren't buying into it because they didn't see a benefit. Even, you know, people internally had concerns about how we're judging some of these people. And we did an audit, or I did an audit, and it came up that the people that were being submitted to the program were coming from a high crime area, which was minority dominated area in Phoenix. So it skewed the numbers on there. And we needed to look at how we're going to fix this problem, because on paper, it looked like we were racially profiling on there. It had the potential of, you know, being misunderstood. People look at stats and numbers and look at it and, you know, say, hey, this is wrong. So we wanted to address it. And unfortunately, the supervisor at the time more or less retaliated against me. And there were some issues that came up in a hearing later on with a merit hearing. Some information was falsified on reports that I had done, and I got written up for violating policies that didn't exist. I got terminated, and I filed a complaint with the merit board, and I was ruled by the merit board that I was a victim of retaliation, and I need to be rehired with back pay and everything like that on there. So I got rehired, and then during the course of the new administration, the prior supervisor was removed and left, and the prior administrator had left on there and either terminated or quit in lieu of termination type situations on there. And then I was brought back to supervise the unit that had been terminated from. So it's kind of ironic in going through a situation like that. You understand, you know, learning lessons from that would be make sure that you document your work. You know, unfortunately, not everyone in law enforcement is ethical in their conduct on there. And, you know, I learned that lesson, but I also understood, because I had such a solid reputation with people in the office, that, you know, as soon as they heard that I was terminated, I started getting phone calls from people saying, you know, I got offered, one of the attorneys had a friend that needed a paralegal, so they were giving me temporary work until I got hired back or could get back on my feet with some of this stuff. And, you know, that was a good part of it, was because I had that solid reputation of doing good work and credibility with stuff. I had a lot of people reaching out with support on there, and they're like, you know, this is not right, this is wrong, and all this type of stuff. And, you know, the accusations being made against you are wrong. And I had people that were willing to testify in my merit hearing. I had several people in the unit that testified, but I also had, you know, additional attorneys and other people that said, you know, call me. But because of time limits on how those merit hearings work, I was only allowed so many witnesses and so much time. But, you know, it's a good feeling with coming back, and all the people were like, yeah, you know, you stood up for what was right at a time when we needed someone to do that. So,
yeah. So let's get into that aspect of it, because that's what I think is fascinating, is the point in time where I understand that this program is deemed questionable and have some racial profiling aspects to it. But how did you get caught specifically in the middle of it to where you felt, I got to go against the grain of my team, but it's the right thing to do?
Well, it was basically because of the program that the software programs that we were using and the databases and the program that was being implemented at the time. Again, you know, it wasn't racial profiling on there, but it gave the appearance of racial profiling because of the scoring system that we used. We scored basically on law enforcement contacts and prior arrests and things like that. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times those are homeless people that are being contacted by law enforcement. They're not always arrested, but they're being contacted a lot on there, the homeless and the transients and things like that. And, you know, officer fills out a FI card to document their contact with the person. Now, all of a sudden, those numbers start getting generated more and more. What happened with my specific situation was that we were looking at, you know, we had several hundred people that were identified, and I think we were losing the focus on going after the true crime drivers. And we were just looking at people that were being contacted a lot on there. So I did an audit and did a memo to my boss saying, you know, these are the issues that we have, and we need to get back focusing on what the initial objective of this program was, to go after the true crime drivers on there, not just the nuisance people. You know, those are calls for service on there, but they're not the ones who are committing the most crime, and they're not always generating the biggest drug deals and lack of, you know, the shot callers in the gang setting on there. Those are the people that we should be going after and putting our resources into who's committing. So that led to me doing a memo to my supervisor at the time, which outlined the concerns. I outlined, you know, how many people had been trained and how many people weren't using this program because they had expressed concerns about it on there. So the officers that were using it were doing it correctly and doing the right way the program was set up. We just needed to tweak it and fix it on there. And I think I go back, you know, the patrol officer is the one who knows who the biggest problems are in the neighborhood on there. It's not always the person in the database on there. And, you know, we need to be aware of that type of situation and understand who the officers are identifying. And they're the ones who should be working with the prosecutor on the problems in the area. And then the analysts should be providing support for those investigations that way. And I think it was just the way the program had been set up, was the analysts were identifying these people off of numbers and statistics. And I think that we missed the input from more officers that we should have had.
So the retaliation, was that just being fired, or were there any other retaliatory acts?
Well, it was a process on it, because I got written up after I sent the memo. Then there was, I think, 7 or 8 formal write-ups that were based off of false information and false, you know, I got accused of violating a policy and procedure that never existed. I got accused of a report not having information, even though I had the email going back to that supervisor showing that he deleted information out of a final report on there. And that was brought up during the merit hearing on there. So it just, to me, it goes back to leadership and ethics in our profession, in law enforcement across the board on there. It, you know, it showed what a bad supervisor could do to a unit, because, you know, I was the one who's taking the brunt, but other people in the unit were also experiencing, you know, frustrations and questioning, you know, being here on it, just because the environment was so toxic at that time on there. But, you know, obviously once he was removed, things got a lot better and we're doing what we should have been doing. It just, he lacked experience and lacked knowledge of what he should have been doing in this situation. And it just snowballed from there on there. So it took a bad situation. And from the personality of being a supervisor, you need to listen to your employees and their input. And yeah, you can have your directions and you have your policy procedures that need to be followed. But if something's not going right, listen to the people who have experience and knowledge, and then look at correcting it before it gets out of control. And unfortunately, it wasn't corrected. You know, we could have easily fixed some of the behind the scenes issues and worked on it, and would have implemented the program the way it should have been if we had actually followed the knowledge that we should have on there and policy procedures and making sure that we stayed within what we should have been staying within instead of just trying to do too many things.
Well, good for you for sticking to your guns, or so to speak. And yeah, it had to be such a tough decision. You'd like to think that all of us in that situation would do the right thing and stay to our ethics. But the idea of working with a team and being a team player, that peer pressure sometimes will get to us.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I saw coworkers that they wanted to do stuff, but because, you know, they had to pay bills and they had no other, you know, fortunately, my wife is an attorney, so we were able to get by for a month or two on her salary with it. But, you know, I had her support, had other people's support on stuff. And, you know, I was in a situation of having years of experience and having networks and contacts that when I did get fired, I had people reaching out, you know, trying to help me with get jobs right away on there. Not everyone else has that experience and that fortunate support group and support network. But, you know, that had also taken years and years of building up that contact and that, you know, credibility. You know, if I had been a jerk to people in the past, you know, that situation, I could have been hung out to dry and, you know, had no support system on there. And, you know, I think it goes back to having the ethics to do the right thing. And, you know, looking back, it was also a very difficult time to go through on there because I had interviewed with other law enforcement positions. And when you go through the background check, as everyone who's gone through understands, when you're sitting there saying, you know, I have a, you know, termination hearing pending before a merit board, and you're doing an interview with the law enforcement agency, they want nothing to do with that situation. So, you know, it was difficult to express that in interviews, but it was the truth because it was going to come up with a background check no matter what. It still comes up if I apply for a position now, explaining that gap time period of work and, you know, just understanding because you have to go through those background checks and law enforcement. Why did you get terminated? I kind of joke now, I have a 19-page ruling showing that everything I did was right, but that could have gone opposite. It could have been, you know, the merit board saying that they still had the right to terminate me on there. But because I had documented so many things from the beginning and that, you know, my coworkers kind of joked with me at the time because I had a 3-ring binder of emails because I knew things were going bad and I had saved that information. So when it came to the hearing, I had documentation that, you know, I had gone to the county attorney, I had gone to other people and raised some of these issues on there. And that helped me with the hearing on there. That made a difference because you have to represent yourself. I couldn't afford an attorney to represent me. And my wife wasn't allowed to represent me as, you know, a family member on there. So I was representing myself, which, you know, went back to the paralegal days and having the knowledge of how to put cases together. So that helped. But, you know, I wouldn't recommend anyone going through that experience. I, you know, fortunately it came out in the right end and I had the support network, but it was a very difficult situation. And, you know, I think the biggest learning lessons from the ethics of a leader is making sure, yeah, if you have a problem employee, that you're doing it correctly and either, you know, you're going through the steps. You know, sometimes, you know, people shouldn't be in law enforcement, should not be in this profession. And as a leader, as a supervisor, you identify those people and you try to help them. And if it's not working out, then, you know, let them know maybe there's other jobs in other areas that you should be working in, but to do it in an ethical and professional manner on there. And even as an employee, making sure that, you know, you're still doing the ethical standards and you're staying within what you need to be doing as an employee, following your guidance. But when something is completely out of line and out of bounds on stuff, that you do have the background and the experience and the backbone to stand up for some of that on there. It's not always an easy path, but, you know, like I made it a comment. I have a, you know, a daughter that's in college right now, and she was trying to get into law enforcement back at, when I was going through this situation. I said in one of my interviews with the local agency, it's, I can't sit there and talk to her about the ethics of law enforcement when I wouldn't have had the background to stand up for myself on there. So it just, you know, those situations on there, it's good that, you know, that person that was a supervisor is no longer in that position, is no longer associated with the crime analysis type situations now on there. They moved on to some other stuff, but something that, you know, it's kind of a, you know, shadow over our unit still with some of the attorneys that have been around here. And, you know, we've worked a lot in the last year, year and a half to increase our professionalism, our ability to work with people. And there's a lot of, you know, positive things that are being said about our unit. We're getting more and more requests on there that people would probably have not sent in a year, 2 years ago under the prior supervision because they didn't trust some of the stuff. Now, you know, that goes back to having a really good staff, having a really good unit that does a lot of good work, and they all, you know, want to do the right thing on there, and they have a positive attitude towards it.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk about you being rehired and that experience and get into some of your advice for the listeners as well as ILEA.
Okay, perfect.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Erin Wickersham from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, and my public service announcement is to go on a court along. You may have been on a ride-along, and I think someone else recommended a 911 operator sit-along. So find a prosecutor in your jurisdiction and see if you can go to court with them. You'll learn a lot about the process and about the work that they're doing.
Hi, this is Paul Arnold, and I just want to tell you the difference between the fast lane and the passing lane is that you're supposed to be passing in the far left passing lane. Even if you think you're going fast enough, get out of the lane.
Welcome back, Brian. I want to continue now. This would be your second tour with Maricopa County. So you get rehired, and how long was it between when you got fired and then when you were rehired?
It was about a 6-month period. When I got terminated, I had within 10 days to file the notice of the merit hearing, but because of the issue of trying to get my paperwork and discovery, because once you obviously you get terminated, you don't have access to your emails, you don't have access to your files and all that kind of stuff. So I had to go through a process of more or less a civil litigation with the county, with the merit hearing on there to get access. Like I was talking about the reports that were altered, those type of items that came up, and I knew that, you know, there's some policy procedures that I got written up for that didn't exist. And I'd sent in public records requests for that information. And, you know, they went through that whole process. And then I had to go through a hearing. It took about a month after the hearing for the ruling to come back by the hearing commissioner. Once they ruled, the county could have appealed or I could have appealed on the hearings. Obviously, I wasn't going to appeal when I was told that, you know, they had to hire me back on stuff. But we just basically came to negotiations on it. And, you know, I was just looking more for my credibility and getting a job. Once I won the case, I had a couple of attorneys who had turned down the case before because, you know, they wanted a lot of money to represent me in the hearing. Once they found out I won the hearing on my own, all of a sudden they wanted to represent me in a, you know, suit against the county. And, you know, they're like, oh, you're good. You know, you could drag this out for a while and get a lawsuit. And I was like, you know, I'm not into that on there. I just want, you know, work in law enforcement. It's a credibility issue more than anything on there. And, you know, I negotiated with the county to come back and get my back pay and all that kind of stuff for the period I was out. And then, you know, they brought me back in to another area that was the analytical side, but it was more statistical side until they restructured and they're kind of deciding what they're going to do. Because at that time, the prior county attorney was appointed to the Supreme Court for Arizona and a new county attorney was appointed. And she was making changes within the office and what programs are going to stay and different things like that. And I had worked with her in the past. So she had approached me and we talked about, you know, some options on how to improve the unit and make the changes and, you know, some of the stuff that we'd highlighted on there, and went through a whole process with the, you know, executive staff on some of those items, on the direction that they were making. And they put us under the investigation unit versus being a standalone unit, and some, you know, behind the scenes stuff that would help with our credibility and our work and budgets and things like that. So once that got worked out, then I was offered the supervisor position back right before COVID, February to March timeframe, right as I got appointed as a supervisor when COVID hit. So we had those challenges as soon as trying to reestablish and, you know, re-implement the program under a new leadership, and then all the challenges of everything basically being shut down with the courts and people having to work remotely, and those challenges that everyone went through, budget issues, you know, staffing issues on there. So
quickly back to when you get rehired and you're coming back into the office, what was your feeling at the time? Do you feel vindicated? Do you still feel a little sheepish because I'm a little bit of embarrassed that the whole thing had to go on? Just how are you feeling as you're walking back into that office that day?
I was vindicated on there, but you did have that, you know, second guess on some of it. I had, you know, people I was friends with that came up and they're like, you know, you really want to come back to this on there? And I was like, yeah, I, you know, want to come back because I still believe in the mission of what we should be doing, the crime analysis unit within the county attorney's office. You know, one of the first comments I told to our staff, the unit, was we should be the best unit to work for in the office because we're getting asked to work on a wide range of things. We're not being, you know, only sex crimes or only gangs or only, you know, we get asked to work on every major type case that comes through. We get asked to give our input. So it should be the most fun working in one of the most fun units in this office on there. So that's the way I looked at it. If it's done right and implemented correctly on it, we should be, you know, it's very challenging, very difficult, you know, a lot of stress with it. But at the end, when you look at, you made a difference in cases and you've actually done something to put a criminal in prison or, you know, behind bars on there and held them accountable for what they were doing, a lot of people don't have that opportunity. And as a prosecution office or as a law enforcement, you have that opportunity to do something when, you know, 99% of the population doesn't have the opportunity to do that. So that was the motivation on there. And, you know, I wanted to move forward with this, you know, the days of working the reserve stuff and, you know, out in the field and, you know, being out at accident scenes and, you know, I was getting, you know, closer to 50 now and didn't want to be doing that type of stuff anymore. I kind of enjoyed the weekends at home versus being out in a patrol car, or, you know, things like that. And that was a different phase. You know, that's a younger person job nowadays. Now I, you know, want to be a, kind of a mentor as I'm getting towards retirement and be able to share experience and be able to mentor the next generation of people to do stuff on there. So that's kind of where I was at coming back to the office. I wanted to look at, you know, how could I be doing more to establish, you know, the profession, networking, and, you know, last couple of years that I'm still doing this to set up the next generation of people, lack of better terms, generation, but, you know, the next group of people that are going to be doing this from either the gangs or ILEA or associations and stuff like that, to start developing the next generation of supervisors and leaders within the program and expand what we do and how we do it and be better at what we were doing than what I was doing 15 years ago.
So you mentioned you become a supervisor early in 2020, and then of course COVID hits, and that gives a whole set of challenges in itself being a supervisor in that time period, but you're also revamping the whole entire program. So what are some of the goals that you came in with as a supervisor, and what's the plan to accomplish them?
Well, I was a supervisor at Department of Public Safety too when I was at the gang unit. So I used some of that stuff and ideas on the policy procedures. And, you know, you're looking at revamping some of the programs. It's a little different, obviously, in a prosecutor's office than in a law enforcement. There's some restrictions on what we can do, what we can't do, in terms of we're not the investigating agency like I did when I was at the Department of Public Safety. You know, we're involved with the investigation here. It's we're working with the prosecutor on stuff. So the most of the investigation's already done. We're helping them prepare the case for trials on there. There are sometimes that, you know, active investigations that we get involved with conflict of interest and things like that. But, you know, there's revamping of what we can do, like social media stuff on there. We had to, there's challenges from an analyst in the county attorney's office because we can't have direct contact with people on there. So we have to make sure that we're not using ghost accounts like you could do at an investigation agency. So we had to, you know, make sure we're implementing the correct way of doing that within our office, because, you know, we're having to operate under what the attorney's standpoint is and their, you know, bar ethics and things like that, that you don't necessarily have from the law enforcement standpoint. You have law enforcement can do covert activities and things like that, that not necessarily we could do from the county attorney standpoint. So, you know, we had to look at making sure that we're doing things correctly. Plus, you know, with the way the unit had operated before, it didn't have individual people within the unit had credibility, but as a unit, it wasn't looked at in the most positive manner on there. So a lot of it was revamping the feelings towards the unit as a whole and, you know, credibility with the attorneys. Just like any agency, when you lose credibility, it's a lot harder to regain it on there. So there's a lot of focus on making sure that we're providing the services that the attorneys want versus what we were telling them that we're going to give them on there. So I've seen it in training programs where people are, you know, the analyst needs to drive the investigation and drive things. And that's not how it operates in the prosecutor's office on there. And, you know, we needed to take a step back and provide support and provide the information that the attorneys needed and not necessarily the direction that we thought we should go in on there. So it's just a lot of revamping and just tweaking. Fortunately, I had a really good staff. You know, everyone in our unit was really positive. And, you know, when I got back as a supervisor, they're really happy that, you know, we're going to be working together as a unit. We're going to be moving in a positive direction. So it made it a lot easier. The negative feelings I think some of them had in the past were gone away. And, you know, I could ask them to do a lot of work and they're always willing to step up and take on extra responsibilities on there, which made it a lot easier. And it helped with our unit, especially as we went through the COVID situation. And I had a lot of support from our chain of command here on making sure that we're revamping it and moving forward with it. We moved under the investigations. So, you know, we have a lot of detectives that were coming to me saying, how can we help you? How can we be successful with what we're doing? Because they didn't like the way the prior program was being run. But now that they had, you know, support and they wanted to, you know, offer their assistance and making sure. And I think that helped with the transition and coming back. And why I came back was because I had a lot of support when I came back to this position.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. I do want to talk about Hialeah because you are the president of the Southwest chapter.
Yes.
And so let's just talk about what your goals are as president and what you hope to accomplish for the chapter.
We had really good leadership before the, you know, past couple of presidents. They were really focused on developing training. And what I would like to do is continue that, but I want to, you know, try to get more cross between the swarm side and the analyst side. I think that's still a challenge for Hialeah and the Analyst Association as a whole in the profession. Is there's always the challenges between sworn and non-sworn in agencies. And I think that what we do as analysts would help a lot of detectives, especially in small agencies. The Southwest chapter covers Arizona, Nevada, and New Mexico. And outside of major cities like Albuquerque and Phoenix and Las Vegas, you know, most of our agencies are small agencies that may only have one or two analysts on there, or they may not even have analysts. They have detectives that are doing that type of analytical work. So I'd hope to, you know, network with those smaller agencies and provide networking and sharing of information. One of the things that I talked with our board, our chapter board, was also trying to do like an incident response, because unfortunately, you know, we looked at the shootings in Las Vegas with the mass shooting up there. We've had serial shootings here in Phoenix and other areas across the country. Is how can we help those resources that get depleted when there's a major incident on, you know, situations of a mass shooting or mass casualty event or something like that? You know, as a chapter, is there something that we could do more to help our members that, you know, if something happens in, you know, hypothetically Albuquerque, New Mexico, and they only have so many resources, is there a way that we could provide assistance even from Phoenix or from Las Vegas or Reno or other areas? So, you know, I'm looking at options on that. We're doing some training coming up in Henderson later this month on cross training with National Insurance Crime Bureau and also the Tri-State Association meeting groups, and trying to network with other law enforcement associations and meeting groups and do some joint training, you know, with Rimmon. They're always a positive supporter of ILEA, other associations. If we can do, you know, cross training and cross networking of resources and bringing in different instructors, different topics. I know that, you know, the big push now is towards real-time crime analysis, and it's not always the bulletin that comes out 3 or 4 days later after an event. It's, you know, what's happening now with the shooting situation. So I think that's an area that we're going to focus on as a chapter in networking. So, you know, if there's a shooting situation, we can get that information sharing immediately versus, you know, 1 or 2 days later when a lot of the information may be stale or it's beyond what it should have been on there. Just, you know, a lot of times you see more information in news than what we share as law enforcement.
The Southwest chapter covers quite a large area. So yes, even before COVID, it must have been a challenge to get all the members together to hold networking opportunities.
Yes, on there. So that's another area that we need to look at, is bringing in people from like New Mexico. We only had a handful of people that were members in New Mexico. So we needed to expand that out on there, trying to get out to those conferences and those trainings. I've been working with some of the agencies out there trying to get their increase in numbers. And unfortunately, it was always, we're either in Phoenix or, you know, the Nevada area, Las Vegas on there. And we need to hit those outlying areas. Even within Arizona, we always kind of focus on the Phoenix area and should have a little bit more focus on Tucson and the border crisis and border issues on there. So those are areas that we need to expand as well, because that impacts everything on there. And, you know, even California did some partnership and training a couple months ago in San Diego. We had 16 agencies that were there. So it was taking those steps in that direction of sharing information on there. And one of the analysts at the time at that training was working border stuff in San Diego, and she didn't have a contact in Arizona. And we were able to set that up after that training so that she was able to get information going back and forth, because of what's impacting them, they're going to see in Arizona as well on there. So that's kind of the focus on the networking and sharing of resources and information and going back and forth.
So ILEA turns 40 this year, and we actually here at the podcast, LEA Podcast, are going to be hosting a series of panel interviews talking about the history of ILEA in its 40 years. And so those will be published middle of September through October. October is the anniversary month for ILEA. So those will be published each Wednesday from the end of September into October. So I just wanted to ask you, you know, when you look back, what does ILEA turning 40 mean to you?
I think it just, you know, shows the progression of the profession on there. You know, I kind of look back at like paralegals were not taken serious early on. I think that, you know, that progression kind of mirrors what analysts are going through the last decade or so. Fortunately, when I was doing my reserve stuff, I had the opportunity to work with some of the analysts at DPS on there, and they're just starting to evolve programs and, you know, networking and information. And I think that looking at ILEA for 40 years of being able to network and share and develop that, I think that's the biggest takeaway from there, is the progression of the professionalism of the position versus, you know, you're just not doing a chart. You're not just running a name in a database. You know, now you're actively involved with investigations. You're actively involved with training and networking with the sworn side. As you take steps forward, we also, you know, need to make sure that we're working with in our dedicated area. I would like to get more sworn people involved with ILEA, because I think the training and the networking and the investigation of putting a case together would mirror what they're doing. And I think that, you know, sometimes the sworn people have the stereotype towards an analyst, that's probably not accurate on it. And the stuff that they're doing as an officer or as a detective is a lot of time analytical type work and the mindset with how they approach a case. And it just, you know, if they use the analyst correctly, they could focus more on some of the sworn side of stuff that they need to do and let the analyst do the analytical work, not take away their time because they have limited time and resources on what they're doing. And I think, you know, that would be a challenge that we still need to overcome in the next 40 years. But, you know, as more and more detectives are getting computer literate, it's not the old days of, you know, an officer that was scared to use a computer. Now, you, most officers have more knowledge on computers and technology than they did 40 years ago on there. So it wasn't as specialized, but kind of refocus on the intel or the analytical side and the crime trending and the technology aspect of it, of computer forensics and cell phone analysis and crime mapping. And, you know, kind of talk about the CSI effect on their prosecutors have seen that where people watch crime scene shows and now they want to see why is there not DNA evidence on the drug possession case on this, because I saw it on CSI or I watched it on, you know, Law and Order or something like that on there. So I think that, you know, those are the challenges that we have to overcome moving forward from the analytical standpoint is, you know, people want to see the cell phone analysis. They want to see the computer forensics. They want to see that type of stuff. So I think those are going to be the challenges in the next decades. And I think that's where ILEA having the foundation of 40 years of networking and training and sharing information and professional development and standards of the ILEA, what an analyst standards for hiring and training and all that kind of stuff that's been implemented over the last several years, that's where we need to continue to grow. And, you know, going back to when I got terminated, it was unethical behavior, but, you know, those are still challenges. We still have the ethics and we still have that challenge on there is making sure that we put the ethical people in leadership. And I think that's where ILEA sets the standards and networking and sharing information with people.
All right, let's move on to some advice that you have for our listeners. As you look back, started 26 years ago, is there something that you thought of back then that you said, oh, by 2021, we'll have this figured out in law enforcement analysis, and yet we're still struggling with it today?
I would say the biggest issue is communication. On there, I think we take steps forward on sharing information and then we take steps backwards, kind of shoot yourself in the foot when we put out bad information. And I think that's where it's always a challenge. And I think I would hope that we'd be better at it. But in agencies that don't share like RMS systems and you don't know what agency 15 minutes from here has in their cases and they're sharing information, we do bulletins, but they're usually after the fact and they're not real time sharing information. You know, we could look at fusion centers, we could look at all of the different programs out there, but I think that that's still the biggest challenge for us. It's a catch-22 situation because you don't want to compromise information. I've had, you know, investigations that were compromised and information that was leaked out that should have never been leaked out. But I think that's the biggest challenge. We'll still have that challenge moving forward, even with the advances in technology from emails and SharePoint and databases and everything like that, is who's going to share their information and who's not going to share their information, and making sure that, you know, what goes in is accurate and correct and not just garbage. You know, something I thought would be a little bit more resolved going back to even the 9/11 commission, you know, what was some of the failures was information sharing on there. And we're still challenging with that nowadays. And it's, you know, 20 year anniversary coming up.
As you mentioned, it's a lot easier to share data, but there's also way more data to analyze. So it's definitely a challenge getting the information out that's consumable to the audience.
Yeah, and making sure, you know, you're putting out the right information and validating it and making sure it's correct, because I've seen bad information put out and that has, you're spending more time fixing the mistakes of bad information than if you had just vetted it and made sure that the information was correct before it was sent out.
If somebody is listening here and they're looking to get into gang investigations as an analyst, what advice would you have for them?
Go to as many of the trainings as possible in networking. I have a couple of people in the office that want to come into our unit at some point in time. I was telling them, you know, try to get into the basic analytical courses first So you understand 28 CFR, how to put cases together, how to put what you can do and what you can't do, how to document it correctly. And, you know, like the gang databases, those are challenging right now because issues in California with people that misuse the database. So understand the basics first and then start getting into the associations, either ILEA training or your local gang association on there, your gang task forces, get with your detectives, start networking with it, and then start just reading and understanding. If you want to work in bikers, you want to work in street gangs, you want to work in prison gangs, understand how those gangs operate, who the leadership, the structure, who the players are on there, the history of them, and how they developed. And I think that that's where, you know, a lot of people, I just want to work gangs on there, but they don't understand the amount of time and effort it takes to learn that. And it could be any area on there. If you want to work narcotics, you want to work sex crimes, you want to work vehicular crimes, or even if you're just doing statistical analysis, you're not doing the intel side of stuff, you're doing it from a statistical standpoint, is get out and talk to your officers. If you're doing staff studies on, you know, how to allocate resources, and you're working with the chief or command staff on how to deploy troops, is understand that you can look at the database, and but that's only giving you a partial aspect. You still need to get out and talk to the human side of stuff on there and your patrol officers, because they, there's a lot of stuff that they may be doing that they know the problems, they know the issues, but they may have dealt with someone multiple times. Instead of documenting it on a FI card or citation, they gave a verbal warning and moved the person on because there are other calls pending on there. So they have those ideas and that information. And I think that's where we need to be getting back into some of the human intelligence of stuff and human side of stuff, and not just focusing only on databases. So I think for someone who really wants to start, understand the technology is changing and the advances in cell phone, all that type of stuff, and computer forensics, but also don't forget to know how to talk to people and how to write reports and how to communicate with people. Because if you can't do that, then you're still going to have the challenges of getting the information you need to do your job if you don't have those resources and those contacts and that networking. And, you know, if people can't talk to you and you don't want to talk to people, you're not going to get the information you need to do your job.
And just looking through your resume too, there's plenty of associations out there. It seems like there's an association for everything. So that's definitely an opportunity to network and get to know the people in the field.
Yeah, any area that you want to work in, you know, from the law enforcement, there's a meeting group or networking or information on there. It doesn't have to be gangs. It could be any area on there, even, you know, law enforcement planners on there. If you're a stats person and you're looking at staff studies, if you're that side of the analytical side of stuff on there, there's all kinds of different associations that you can work with and network with. That's the key thing, is you're not going to get all the information on your own. No one's going to know everything. So you need to have the resources. And if something happens, it's great to have those resources. We had a shooting spree that occurred here in the West Valley in Phoenix several months ago, and having the contacts in Las Vegas, I was able to reach out to a friend of mine up there, and she went back to work and pulled up reports on the suspect that helped us with the information. And, you know, that's not going to happen if you don't have those contacts and those resources and networks already in place before something happens.
Very good. You also have plenty of teaching opportunities that you've done in the past, and you have several writings. So what's next for you?
I would like to contact a Remen with trying to do some analytical courses on there from the Southwest ILEA chapter. And I think that, you know, I was talking with the past president, Chris, and we're looking at, you know, trying to do some real crime trainings and do some more training along that and bridge that gap between analysts and law enforcement, the sworn side that I talked about earlier. I would like to continue to do some more trainings like that. With the writings on there, I don't have as much time now because I don't have the direct investigative side of stuff like I did when I was at the gang task force. And, you know, I'd still like to do some more like in the future with that, but you need to have the hands-on experience. I think that goes back to like credibility. If your information's, you know, kind of stale, you need to get back into the trenches and understand what's going on before you put out too many things on the writing material. So, you know, I would like to train the new analysts coming up, network with new people that want to get into the profession and offer experiences and let them understand, you know, this is important, how you document your work, how you communicate with people, pass on the information I have from years on there, because I think from the historical standpoint, we're losing a lot of that historical aspect. I see a lot of officers I work with that have retired that had that institutional knowledge of either gangs or drugs or, you know, homicide investigations and that training. And I think that that's where we're missing some of that stuff and documenting that in the future.
Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And this is when you can promote any idea that you wish. Brian, what are your words to the world?
I would just, you know, kind of go back to don't be a database or a cubicle cop on situations. You know, the database analyst that only does stuff sitting at a desk and doesn't get out and network with people. I think that that's where in the future and what you need to be doing successfully is to get out and go to meetings, go to training, go to networking, share your information and gain that credibility, get involved with as much as you possibly can. You know, I had the opportunity to do a lot of writing when I was at Rimmon and publications, and that helps you if you have to testify in court or teaching and get out and train the next generation of people on there, because standing in front of a group of students and teaching opportunities helps you in the future if you have to testify in court or if you have to go do a defense interview. You understand how to communicate better with that and understand how to promote your ideas and defend your ideas, because from the analytical standpoint, we're going to get, lack of better terms, attacked on a lot of stuff because we're the ones putting out information, intelligence, and doing the databases. And I think we need to defend that and being able to communicate on there. So I think that, you know, again, don't be just a database analyst or don't be a cubicle cop. If you're on the sworn side, get out and do stuff and get involved with associations and training and networking with everyone.
Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Brian. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you. And if anyone has questions or concerns, wants to reach out, you'll have my contact information and feel free to pass that on to anyone. So I want to, you know, help people, the next generation of people coming up.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.